Hi, I'm Neil Stavem. I want to thank you for listening to this podcast from Connecting Faith. There are many more podcasts available at our website, myfaithradio.com. And your support makes this possible.
Real conversations about how we live out our faith every day. Welcome to Connecting Faith.
When it comes to the global refugee crisis, will we respond in fear or compassion? That's the question we're going to address today on the program. We'll talk about the plight of the refugee. We'll get some understanding about resettlement. How do we help without hurting? And the ways that the church can respond, and maybe ways that it's not already. And look forward to introducing our guests in a few minutes. Ted, lots of concerns in the world today. And, you know, at the heart of many of them, the need for justice.
Yeah, more news stories coming out today, attacks at a church in France and other things. It's really sad to hear these things.
Yes, and of course we've got the political conventions going on, which seems to be kind of a time to speak negatively about those that have an opposing view, which I think brings up our memory verse yesterday. We were doing memory verse Monday yesterday from Ephesians 4:29. Do not let any unwholesome talk come out of your mouths, but only what is helpful for building others up according to their needs, that it may benefit those who listen. Wow, that's kind of countercultural, isn't it?
Yeah, right, especially when you read a headline and your initial impulse is to react.
Yeah.
Stop for a second, take that verse to heart.
All right, Ephesians 4:29 is our verse for the week. Well, we were talking about justice and the concern about justice, certainly helping refugees, that has a justice component to it as well. But we're talking in the month ahead about our partnership with the International Justice Mission to see a big dent in the end of trafficking through the work of International Justice Mission. We're looking to raise some funds for that, as well as raising our heart rates and getting in better shape.
So. Yeah, Faith Fitness Challenge. You can still sign up today at myfaithradio.com. Looking to raise $50,000 for International Justice Mission as we help put an end to human trafficking. Find the details there. Sign up today. It's a great cause and a great way to maybe achieve some of those fitness goals.
Sure. And if you're, you know, prefer not to be fit, like, you know, I like to kind of, you know, if you're like me and you want to just help somebody else achieve their fitness goals, and you can be a sponsor for them. So, and it's a great way. Use your social media connections and all those things. So, find out about the Live Free Challenge online, myfaithradio.com. So we're talking about the convention going on, the Democratic Convention, of course, this week. And my thought is that we'll probably see a lot of double standards on display.
Yes.
My guess is that it probably happened last week as well. Mm-hmm. And double standards are at the heart of today's commentary from John Stone Street.
Denial of service must stop, or must it? For the Colson Center for Christian Worldview, I'm John Stone Street with The Point. So Christian movie producer PureFlix wanted a giant billboard to advertise God's Not Dead 2 outside the Republican convention. Orange Barrel Media agreed to the billboard until it saw the message PureFlix wanted. Quote, I'd rather stand with God and be judged by the world than stand with the world and be judged by God. So just before the convention, Orange Barrel Media refused to make the billboard, saying the message was too incendiary. So naturally, the ACLU, the Department of Justice, and major corporations went to bat for PureFlix, protesting Orange Barrel's denial of service, right? Of course they didn't. But of course they would have if it had been an LGBTQ group that had been denied service to promote its message. Next time a friend asserts that Christian businesses must cater gay weddings, tell them about PureFlix. And if they, as they should, defend Orange Barrel Media's decision not to go against its beliefs, ask them why they don't extend the same rights to Christians. I'm John Stone Street.
You're listening to Connecting Faith, and we are in a time in our culture where the topic of refugee resettlement has created a division between those who believe for safety and security reasons there should be a moratorium on refugees entering our country and those who feel with proper vetting America should remain a country that welcomes immigrants and refugees and other immigrants. It's been interesting that we for years have been the, you know, as the Statue of Liberty has invited to all who want to come. The poor, the needy, the outcast. Well, those things have attitude has changed a little bit. We're going to address it today with Matthew Sorens. Matthew is the co-author of a new book called Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. And it is a new out from Moody. We've got a couple copies to give away, and we invite you to call in and sign up for that. Matthew serves as U.S. Director for Church Mobilization for World Relief. And he previously served as the field director for the Evangelical Immigration Table. It's a coalition of evangelical organizations, of which World Relief is a founding member. He's a co-author of the book Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate that came out four or five years ago or so. And he is with us in studio today, and we're honored to have him with us. Matthew, welcome.
Yeah, thanks for the opportunity to be here.
So, Seeking Refuge, Stephen Bauman, your boss at World Relief, and Dr. Issam Smear, I think it is,
yep.
You co-authored this. This is the word crisis, I guess. Is that an appropriate word for what we're experiencing today?
Yeah, unfortunately, I think it is. The UN keeps track of how many forcibly displaced people there are in the world, and they came out with new data just a few weeks ago that there are now more than 65 million forcibly displaced people in the world. About 21 million of those have not only been displaced from their homes, but actually from their countries, which could help them meet the definition of a refugee, which is a higher number than we have ever had in recorded history. We don't have perfect data, for example, on after World War II, how many people were displaced. That was a similar displacement crisis, or after the Vietnam War, we saw some similar things. But we're definitely at a crisis point. And in the midst of that, and in the midst of the horror that that means for so many people, and people whom we believe are made in God's image, we also believe at World Relief that there's a redemptive opportunity for the church to extend the love of Christ to people who are very vulnerable. And we see that happening all over the world. World Relief is working with churches in Jordan and other parts of the Middle East, in Germany with those seeking asylum in Europe, but also in the United States as we partner with local churches to receive refugees who have been resettled here.
As you said, I mean, this is really unprecedented in history. And I think I just saw something that this is about, you know, two out of every five Syrians are displaced. I mean, just taking the country of Syria, that's a phenomenal.
It's hard to comprehend that statistic, but it's true. I mean, it's been about nearly 5 million refugees and about another 7 million displaced internally within Syria. So, I mean, if you can just imagine that translated onto a country like the United States, it'd be everybody east of Ohio having to leave their homes. I mean, can you imagine the chaos that causes? And unfortunately, hundreds of thousands of people killed as well by the civil war that's generating that displacement. But again, it's in the midst of that suffering. I think that it's very natural to have a response on one hand of compassion. I think most people have seen that image of the little boy washed on the beach in Turkey, Alan Kurdi, 3-year-old. You know, I look at him and I see those Velcro shoes and I think of my 1-year-old son. And as a father, I can't help but feel compassion. And then in just a split second, without even a conscious pivot, I start to think, what on earth is he running away from? You know, what makes a father get on that boat? How terrible must it be? And how do we keep that from coming here? So there's this response of fear. And I think not only is the country divided, and maybe some churches are divided between those two responses, but as individuals, many of us feel that tension. Of course, we want to be compassionate. You know, we're followers of Jesus, who himself was a refugee. We ought to care for refugees. But we also have some, I think, understandable concerns. Now, I think there's answers to some of those concerns. But I think those are the competing emotions that are guiding a lot of Americans as we think about this crisis.
And I guess maybe we should talk definitions, because a refugee is someone that has to flee, right? I know that's been some of the debate is, you know, do Christians stay within a country like Syria or Iraq and hold on to their, you know, the Christian faith there? Or do they, I mean, they have, refugees basically are going because they don't have any other choice.
A refugee by legal definition is someone who has fled their country of origin because of persecution or a credible fear of persecution because of their race, their religion, their national origin, their social group, or their political opinion. So I should say there's lots of vulnerable displaced people who don't fall into that definition. But anyone who's been designated as a refugee has proved to some governmental body that they meet that particular definition. So it's not just that they're fleeing poverty, as sympathetic as that may be, or a natural disaster, that's sympathetic too, but they don't meet the definition of a refugee. Or if you fled your home but you didn't leave your country, which is, you know, again, in Syria, you have more than 7 million people in that category. You're not a refugee either under the law. You're an internally displaced person, still very vulnerable, potentially more vulnerable, because the only government you can look to for assistance is usually the government that you fled in the first place. But that definition of refugee is important because people use the terms interchangeably. Refugees are immigrants, but not all immigrants are refugees. It's a subset of all immigrants.
those that are displaced, I mean, they end up in camps or what, with relatives or what typically, I mean, how do they, I guess, get from one spot to another and maybe continuing on eventually maybe to the U.S.?
Yeah. So it is important to note that a very small percentage are ever going to make it to the United States or really to any developed country. The more than 85% of the refugees in the world today are in that second country where they initially fled to. So if you look at the situation in Syria, which again is not all refugees in the world, but is why we've seen so much of an increase in the recent years, you've got 2.5 million refugees in Turkey, more than 1 million in Lebanon, somewhere between 600,000 and 1.5 million in Jordan, depending on whose statistics you trust. And most of those people, there are some living in camps, but especially in the Middle Eastern context, most are not in camps. They're living in an urban context, like in a city like Amman or in Beirut or various cities in the Middle East, which usually means they're paying rent. A lot of these families who were displaced were middle to upper class, so they may have had some cash with them when they fled, but that cash doesn't last very long when you're not given work authorization. That doesn't mean people don't work because they're desperate. One of the young men I interviewed for our book for Seeking Refuge, the Syrian refugee who was resettled eventually from Turkey. He and his wife and his two sisters were all working full time in Turkey, and they couldn't cover their rent payment. I mean, that was part of why they were so desperate there. And again, he's a veterinarian in Syria. He's a skilled guy. He has a lot of education, but he was doing whatever work he could find, but all without authorization and with a lot of mistreatment. So those situations are quite common, and some of that is why, and we've seen a fair number, about 900,000 Syrians, as of the last data that I've seen, who have probably fled initially to a country like Turkey or Lebanon or Jordan, but then tried to cross the Mediterranean Sea to find a long-term secure position in Europe, many of them seeking refuge in Germany eventually. And we're all aware of the tragic reality that that's an extremely dangerous journey. There are traffickers and smugglers willing to exploit that vulnerability, and we've seen that on display. And not just last September with one child, but unfortunately there's been many children since who have lost their lives and not always in the media spotlight.
It doesn't, I would think a country to absorb, 2 million people or 1 million or 900,000. I mean, that obviously Europe has experienced some of that, hasn't it? Germany particularly.
Yeah.
That too, there is some social cost to that too, isn't there?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's the question of how do you integrate that many people? And it is a challenge. I don't think it's impossible. I actually think the German church, and I was in Germany a few months ago, I was incredibly impressed with how churches in Germany are really stepping up. And seeing this as an opportunity for, Germany is not a country where most people are in church on any given Sunday at this point, but the churches that are there are so eager in most cases to welcome those seeking asylum. It's worth noting most of them haven't been designated as refugees by any government in Europe at this point. That takes a little time. So it's sort of a presumed refugee status or an asylum seeker. But churches are welcoming them in, I mean, sometimes literally into their buildings to sleep there. The government provides a lot of those services as well, but the churches are providing friendship. And when I was in Germany, I heard story after story of people coming from a Muslim background coming to Christ because of the welcome of the church. And we do see that happening in the United States as well. It's worth noting we have a tendency in the U.S. to make every issue about ourselves. So you would think, from the news coverage, this was mostly a question of should the U.S. take all the Syrian refugees. Well, the U.S. at this point, 5 years into a war, has taken about 7,000 refugees from Syria. Again, Germany has taken 900,000, and we've taken 7,000. Canada, a smaller country by population just north of us, has taken about 30,000 Syrian refugees. And Syrians are actually a very small percentage of the refugees from all countries in the world that the U.S. receives. That was about 70,000 total last year. But as Syrians do begin to arrive, and part of the slowness is there's a very thorough vetting process that every refugee has to work through. There's no exceptions to that, and it's probably even a bit more strenuous from a country like Syria where there's some legitimate security concerns.
We'll talk more about it here in the moments ahead with Matthew Sorens. Matthew is a co-author of a new book called Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. It is from Moody Publishing. Matthew serves as U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief, and he is a co-author of the book Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate, talking today about the refugee crisis. And we will talk about, all right, what are some of the best ways that we can help those sojourners coming to our communities? And, what kind of trauma are they experiencing, many of them? And we've got some stories about how the gospel is being lived out in powerful ways. All that's coming up here in the moments ahead. We do have some copies of the book that we'll give away, and you can sign up for that at 877-93-FAITH, 877-933-2484.
Give me your eyes for just 1 second. Give me your eyes so I can see everything that I keep missing. Give me your love for humanity.
You're listening to Connecting Faith. Today we connect with Matthew Sorens. Glad to have him in the studio today. Matthew's co-author along with Stephen Bauman and Dr. Assam Smear, a new book called Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. It is one of the significant challenges in our day today. And Matthew has served as the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief for a number of years. Before that, he served as field director for the Evangelical Immigration Table. It's a coalition of evangelical organizations of which World Relief is a founding member, talking about this massive displacement and migration and real opportunity for the church. And again, the premise as the conversation started is that we suddenly seem to have become fearful of refugees. Maybe just, Matthew, to say a little bit about, you know, what actually happens, as you said, you know, we think it's all about the U.S. What does it take actually to get to the U.S. for a refugee? I mean, it's a pretty extensive process.
Yeah, and, you know, it's a political season, and we try to stay out of the political processes, you know, and we're not partisan at World Relief, but part of that dynamic in electoral season is you have candidates saying things like, well, there's no refugee screening process. We have no idea who these people are. And that's just not accurate. When World Relief receives someone at the airport, the State Department sends us a pretty significant set of biographic information, and all that is based on a series of interviews and background checks that they've done overseas before that person shows up. So that process, and again, this is just for the very small percentage, less than 1%, who are even considered for resettlement to a third country like the United States. It usually starts with a referral from the United Nations. So again, you can't actually apply to be a refugee in the United States. You can register as a refugee with the UN, and they might refer you to the United States. They might refer you to Canada or Australia or Sweden, or, you know, you don't necessarily get a say in that. Some cases are referred to the U.S. State Department. The State Department, working with the U.S. Department of Homeland Security and the Department of Defense, the FBI, the National Counterterrorism Center, undergoes a very thorough vetting process. It's a process that usually takes at least 18 months, often much longer, where they are basically both trying to determine that this individual is indeed a refugee, that they meet that legal definition, and that they in no way present any sort of a public safety or public health threat to the United States. So there's a health screening as well. There's usually multiple interviews. Many of the people I interviewed for the book were interviewed 4, 5, 6 times on different occasions. There often will be interviews with others to confirm their story. So if you say, you know, my home was bombed in Aleppo on 10:30 in the morning on Tuesday, you know, whatever the day of the week, they're going to check back. Our intelligence services are going to verify that that's a credible story. We can tell that that actually happened. There's biometric checks, retina scans in many cases. So we have a lot of information on these people. And I think part of the best evidence that that system is working fairly well is that with more than 3 million refugees who've been resettled to the United States since the late 1970s, there's never been a terrorist attack in the U.S. perpetrated by someone who came through that refugee resettlement screening process. And I would say I think that's partially because it's a very thorough process. There's no 100% guarantee. You can't give 100% guarantee of any group of 3 million U.S. citizens either. But it's a very thorough process that I have a lot of confidence in, enough to have refugees living in my house at various points from the Middle East. And I think part of the dynamic is also not just that people were vetted, but that they were welcomed. Because, and that's actually a benefit that most immigrants to the U.S. don't necessarily get. But every refugee who comes in is paired to a refugee resettlement agency. It's like World Relief. We're one of 9 agencies nationally. Most of those are faith-based organizations. So for us at World Relief, at least, our goal is not only to have our caseworker there at the airport when that refugee arrives, but to have a team from a local church who's going to welcome them, who's going to walk alongside them from the first several months that they're here, who are going to help them integrate into the community. And it's worth noting that actually of the refugees resettled to the United States, more in the last 10 years at least, more have been Christians than any other religious background. So people tend to presume this is Muslims. Some are, but most are not. But even where people have some concern about, well, these people could be radicalized, being welcomed is the best antidote to radicalization, because it's really hard to believe ISIS's lie that all Christians are your enemy or all Americans are your enemy when it was a local church that met you at the airport. I was actually just at an event here in the Twin Cities where one of the pastors shared a story of welcoming this refugee family from Somalia. And as they came through the airport, they had a big welcome to the United States sign. And they said, what dignitary was on our plane that they get this sort of greeting? And they got to say, that's for you. We want you to know that you're home. You're welcome. And they said the family just started crying. They said, we've never been welcomed anywhere. Mm-hmm. And people who've been pushed out of one country after another, you know, we have the opportunity as a country, but then as the local church as well, to welcome people in and to let them know that we love them and that God loves them. And many people who aren't yet Christians end up embracing Jesus because of the response of the church.
Which is, just looking at the book, the call to welcome, to care for the stranger was a pretty frequent injunction in the Old Testament, wasn't it?
It is. You know, the Hebrew word for an immigrant or a foreigner in the Old Testament is the word ger. That word alone appears 92 times in the Old Testament. This is actually a really frequent command. Often you'll find the foreigner or the refugee, the immigrant, depending on which translation of the Bible you're reading, mentioned right alongside the orphan and the widow. These were vulnerable groups of people in biblical times, and I think arguably today as well, whom God explicitly loves, whom he commands his people to love, and whom he even set up policies in the law of the Old Testament to make sure that the needs were provided for those vulnerable groups of people. He told the Israelites, you should go over your grapes and your wheat and your olives one time and leave what remains for the foreigner, the orphan, and the widow. Not to say they had a handout, they had to actually go out and work, and you see that in the story of Ruth, who was both a widow and a foreigner. She's out gleaning in the fields because that's what she's entitled to as a foreigner and as a widow. But that was part of God's way of providing for the needs of these vulnerable groups of people. And all of that, I think, works into the idea of loving our neighbor, which, you know, in Luke chapter 10, Jesus is asked, what's the greatest commandment? And he says, well, it's to love God with your whole heart, soul, mind, and strength, and to love your neighbor as yourself. And the lawyer in that story, it says he wanted to justify himself. So he asked, well, who is my neighbor? And you get the sense he wants a very narrow definition. The people on either side of me, as long as they look like me and talk like me and believe like me. And that's not what Jesus says. Jesus tells the story of the Good Samaritan, which it's worth noting was an oxymoron. That term would be an oxymoron to a Jewish listener. Samaritans were not good. They were theologically in error, and Jesus actually affirms that elsewhere. They were ethnically different. Two of Jesus's disciples wanted to call down fire on a Samaritan village. I mean, this is, you think your church is difficult people to work with. Like, Jesus has these, you know, kind of bigoted people who want to smite the Samaritans. But Jesus himself has a very different attitude. He not only says, and I think by implication, you should love the Samaritan, he makes the Samaritan the hero of the story. And I think the application of that for us, and this goes all the way back to the Old Testament, because in Leviticus 19, we're told to love your neighbor as yourself for the first time. It's a few verses later, you're told to love the foreigner who's residing among you. But the implication for us is we can't define our neighbor as narrowly as we might want to. I don't think we can narrow down our neighbor to say it's just of those who are the same religion as you, because those are your neighbors if they're Muslims or they're Hindus or they're Buddhists or they're atheists. And we have an opportunity to love them. And I also would say, I don't think it's dangerous. Again, I'm very confident in our screening process. But even if it was, it certainly was for the Good Samaritan to stop on the side of the road to Jericho. That might be why the priest and the Levite in the story walk on by on the other side. I mean, it's a dangerous part of the road to be stopping on. But part of loving your neighbor might mean some risk, might mean some cost, might mean some inconvenience. But Jesus says, go and do likewise.
We're going to talk more about it. What does it mean to go and do likewise? And what are the best ways that we can help and be welcoming the stranger today? Matthew Sorens serves as U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief. World Relief is a great ministry working with local churches around the globe to share the love of Christ in tangible ways. We'll talk more about them and about the book, Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. Got a couple of copies to give away if you'd like to sign up for that. Or join us with a question. Maybe you've had the opportunity to help some refugees resettle. Love to hear your story. 877-933-2484 is the phone number. That's 877-93-FAITH. More in just a couple of minutes. Can't ignore the whole counsel of Scripture that God cares about the poor, the outcast, the needy, the stranger, the sojourner, whatever you'd like to use as a word. This is an area where the church has been called to serve. And how do we respond in today's increased refugee needs? Is it with fear or compassion? And obviously, fear has sort of been dominating the news on this issue over the last year or so, and the churches for many years have been doing resettlement, and the World Relief is one of the agencies that has been working on resettlement for, what is it, 40 years or so?
It's been almost 40 years now.
Yeah. It's been a long time. Matthew Sorens, by the way, is U.S. Director for Church Mobilization for World Relief. He's one of the co-authors of a new book called Seeking Refuge. Subtitle is On the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis, which it truly is, and unprecedented in history. And yet there's great stories, great things happening. And even though we assume that this is a major problem in the U.S., and the fact is that we only take in what... it was 70,000 over the course of a year, is that?
Yeah, last year the U.S. as a whole took in 70,000 refugees. This year the goal that the State Department has set is 85,000. We'll see if they hit that. Actually, the next few months will be very busy seasons for refugees arriving as they try to meet that goal by the end of the fiscal year, October 1st. But that's still less than one half of 1% of the refugees in the world. So it's a generous response in some ways. I would argue it's a generous response at a normal time, but it's not necessarily a normal time. And I actually think we could be doing more. And I think the church would step up to do more if more were allowed to come in.
Well, you know, speaking of doing more, I just in the book Seeking Refuge, you share a quote from Dr. Martin Luther King, where you're talking about the Good Samaritan. He said, you know, being a Good Samaritan is just the first step, and we all probably need to do that a time or two. But he said, then we need to work to transform the entire Jericho Road as well. So say more about sort of the public policy side.
Yeah,
of this.
I mean, I think Dr. King's, you know, wisdom there is that, of course, we should be loving our neighbor in very tangible ways. And that's most of what World Relief does in partnership with local churches. But part of loving our neighbor might also be asking that question of what's wrong with this road that people keep getting beaten up upon. And so when there are systemic issues at play, that's where we do it, especially in a democracy. We're called in Scripture to be subject to the governing authorities. That gets played out in a democracy is speaking in to the governmental processes and saying, you know, we think our policies can be more effective, both for the interest of the United States, which has historically been blessed by refugees and other immigrants in many, many ways, but also as a compassionate nation and as churches to have the liberty and freedom to be able to welcome refugees who are coming in. And that's one of our concerns because there have been, you know, it's interesting, a year ago, not that long ago, refugees were not controversial. Like, maybe a very small number of Americans were concerned about refugees, but it's always the Refugee Resettlement Program, at least for the decade I've been at World Relief, has had broad bipartisan support in Congress. You know, other immigration issues, well, what about those who are here illegally? Those are controversial questions, have long been controversial. But refugees were, you know, very sympathetic. Everyone has legal status. And that's really changed just in the last 6 to 9 months. It's been, I think, the confluence of an asylum seeker crisis in Europe, which people maybe got confused and realized is not the same situation as the United States. And, you know, and in a political season where people have a reason to maybe have people be upset and worked up about something or another, we have seen a real shift in the American population to the point that now, you know, there's been polls that a slight majority of Americans think we should not be resettling more refugees in the United States. And that impacts the church as well. I mean, there's been at least one poll that white evangelical Christians, at least, majority say we should not proceed to resettle more Syrian refugees in particular. Our attitude at World Relief is really that we think public policy it's an important way for us to engage, not to say let everybody in, to be really clear. We're not saying just, you know, open up the doors to everyone, but we think we actually have a very thorough screening process. And we think both that we should be doing more as a country to help churches and governments and nonprofit entities elsewhere in the world where the vast majority of the refugees are and will remain, but also that we can do a little bit more in the United States at a time of an unprecedented crisis. It's also important to know that that's a foreign policy dynamic. There's a foreign policy dynamic to that, too. I mean, we as a country, our State Department is diplomatically trying to encourage a country like Jordan to keep welcoming refugees because, frankly, it's not in our international interest for them to close their doors, which would be understandable when they've taken in 1 million people. In Lebanon, it's 1 in 4 people who are Syrian refugees. But it's a diplomatic chip that we can play to say, well, we're going to take some too. 10,000 is actually a very small number in a year, but at least shows some level of commitment from the United States to take some of the most vulnerable cases. So with only a small percentage being considered for resettlement, for example, if you look at the Syrian refugees resettled to the U.S., more than 70% have been women or children under the age of 14. It's a lot of single moms. It's a lot of people with some health conditions that they couldn't necessarily get treatment in that second country, and their lives were actually at risk in some cases. Or those who actually faced persecution in that second country. That's unfortunately sometimes a reality as well, or at least discrimination. So it's our way as a country to do our part against part of our national legacy. We have that Statue of Liberty saying, give me your tired, your poor, your teeming masses yearning to breathe free. And it's an opportunity for the church to step up and say, we're going to be there at the airport as this family arrives, even as we come alongside churches in the Middle East, in Europe, and in other parts of the world that are also responding. And we're doing all of that at World Relief. We don't see this as here or there. It's both.
Well, speaking of being at the airport to welcome, that's just one step. But let's expand. What does it look like to help those in our communities? Maybe as a church body, say, you know, we're going to, and of course, obviously, World Relief works strictly with the churches. So what does it look like to welcome the refugee?
Yeah, so it's a process. It's not just a one-time. Sometimes, frankly, it's a little bit of a challenge because churches love to do one-time things, and we like to try to facilitate that where we can. But what refugees really need is not, I mean, they need some stuff. We need financial support, of course. But the biggest need that refugees have is friendship. And you can't do friendship one Saturday a year, you know, with 400 people. It's a one-on-one sort of thing, or maybe it even works better often with a team from a local church. We usually call that a good neighbor team, who will commit to saying, hey, for the first 6 months to 1 year that this family is going to be here, we're going to come alongside them from the airport pickup. And even before that, helping set up an apartment and get everything ready for them. We're going to, you know, do some training, understand where they're coming from so we can be sensitive to their culture and then help them to understand our culture. So there's some technical things there that, you know, World Relief or the other resettlement agencies can help with. But the biggest need is just it's sitting sometimes through some awkward language barriers and being a friendly face who will help someone to understand the bus system or a banking system. Or when you get these letters in the mail that say you won $1 million, that you probably didn't win $1 million. You know, it's things that some of us take for granted, just helping people understand how our society works and being a listening voice. People have gone through, unfortunately, some incredible trauma. I mean, in most cases, that's, you know, part of the definition of being a refugee is having fled fear of persecution. And having someone to listen to that story in a patient way can actually be really healing. And to have someone who you can trust, who proves over time that you can trust them, that they're going to be consistently your friend. You know, we ask church groups to make like a 6 month or 1 year commitment, but our not so secret hope is actually that just becomes a lifelong friendship. Not that the refugee hopefully doesn't need very much, you know, after a year or two, you know, they gradually become self-sufficient. And that's a strong focus for us, is helping people find employment, helping them, you know, be able to meet their own needs. But people always need friendship. And we've seen that happen time after time all over the country. And sometimes relationships that go right on into eternity. People, whether they were already strong believers, and we have a lot to learn from the persecuted church who sometimes gets resettled into our own communities. And then those who weren't yet believers who, through the interaction with a team from a church, you know, ask those questions of, so who is Jesus? Who do you, you know, what does that mean? I've seen that in my own community where I lived. I had a Somali guy came to one of my friends who's his English teacher and asked, hey, you know, in my refugee camp in Ethiopia, I heard about this movie called The Jesus Film. You know, can you get me that in my language? And it turns out we can. That's possible. And, you know, there's an opportunity for someone. We're not the great evangelists at his door telling people about Jesus. And when we're very careful, we don't do proselytization. There's never any element of force or pressure. But we do believe in evangelism, the open invitation to here's who we believe Jesus is. This is what we believe a relationship with him is. And when people have been loved and welcomed by the local church and shown the love of Christ in tangible ways, they're very likely to ask those questions. And that allows us to, as First Peter says, be ready to give an answer for the hope that's within us.
Matthew, this started for you, right, just on a college campus, just befriending a refugee family, right?
Yeah, you know, I was a senior in college, and there was a good friend of mine in my college who was volunteering with World Relief with a family of five kids, and four were girls, and one was a boy, a teenage boy. And she just really felt like Dennis, this young man, would benefit from having a male mentor. So she, you know, kind of begged me, and would you just like come once a week? And I thought, I can handle once a week. And Dennis became a good friend, and his family became good friends. And when I finished college, I moved into their apartment complex and started working at World Relief just about the same time. But as this became a very personal issue for me, you know, we talk about loving our neighbors. These people were literally my neighbors, and they fed me. I mean, I was a single guy at the time. I gained a lot of weight living in that apartment complex because people kept bringing me this delicious food, not necessarily one meal per dinner time, but two or three sometimes. And I didn't know how to say no to that because it's kind of a hospitality culture. You're supposed to say yes, and it's amazing food. But, you know, those families became just really good friends. More, you know, not I wasn't there to help them necessarily. I didn't necessarily have a ton to offer. But I could offer, you know, I could play basketball with kids, and I could, you know, I ended up doing a Bible study with some of the kids in the neighborhood and got to see one good friend baptized at our church, which was really amazing. A number of people actually have gotten to see baptized, including some, you know, some who were from Christian families, but others were not. And they made that decision to start following Jesus. So it's been, you know, it's been a privilege for me, and it's also why I think there's a lot of fear around this issue when we hear about statistics, you know, like 21 million refugees in the world. But that doesn't mean much to most people. But when you know Dennis, or you know Rami, the Syrian refugee in my community in Aurora, Illinois now, or you know Pingala, the woman in Spokane, Washington, who I got to interview from Bhutan, those stories actually can really change your perspective. And that's part of what we're trying to do with the book, is tell some of those stories. They're not all the same. I mean, there's not one, you know, people want like one story to summarize all 21 million people. And they're neither angels nor demons, and that shouldn't surprise us as Christians, that they're all made in the image of God with inherent dignity and potential. They're all fallen people just like the rest of us. They've gone through some trauma that probably distinguishes them from a lot of the rest of us, and there's some healing that needs to happen there. But we believe that that healing is possible, and we've seen that happen time after time.
The book is called Seeking Refuge on the Shores of the Global Refugee Crisis. It's new, just out from Stephen Bowen, Dr. Isam Smear, and Matthew Sorens. Matthew serves as the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief, and he is with us today. He is also a co-author of the book called Welcoming the Stranger, Justice, Compassion, and Truth in the Immigration Debate. And we're going to take a quick break and come back with more in just a moment. Called Seeking Refuge. It's written by experts from World Relief, a global organization serving refugees, offering a practical, well-rounded, well-researched guide to the issue of the global refugee crisis, of which it is. And as Matthew Sorens, who is the U.S. Director of Church Mobilization for World Relief, has said, you know, this didn't used to be a kind of a fear issue. I mean, we were welcoming the refugee, the stranger. That has changed just over in the last year, it seems, obviously, because of many asylum seekers and the great crush coming into places like Turkey and Europe, and a bunch of that happening because of unrest, ISIS, and their growing issues across Syria and Iraq. But places like Burma and Somalia, Ukraine, other places, I mean, the refugees really, from almost around the globe, any place. Right?
Yeah, I think that's an important point. People tend right now to think refugee and probably think of Syria and think of someone who's of the Muslim religion. And there's this rumor that they're all male. That's just not really accurate at all. But the reality is the number one country of origin last year for refugees resettled to the U.S. was Burma or Myanmar in Southeast Asia. 70% of those people are ethnic minority Christians, mostly Baptists and Anglicans. You know, who the Baptists celebrate Adoniram Judson every year, who was the Baptist missionary who shared the gospel with them, you know, a century or more ago. And, you know, it's a remarkable story of Christian faith who are persecuted in that country because of their faith. And we see that also, for example, with the Iraqi refugees, which is another large group in the last 7 to 8 years. 35% of them have been Christians of one sort or another, so mostly Catholic or Orthodox. So as we welcome them, we actually have an opportunity to welcome the persecuted church. And, you know, Jesus says in Matthew 25 that by doing so, we're not just welcoming the persecuted church, we're welcoming him. He says, I was hungry, you gave me something to eat. I was thirsty, you gave me something to drink. I was a stranger and you invited me in. And he goes on to say, whatever you did for one of the least of these, my brothers, my sisters, you did unto me. And I think about that personally. If I was forced to flee my home, that's probably hard for most Americans to really envision that, you know, our lives were in danger. We're not talking about persecution like your Starbucks cup doesn't say Merry Christmas, but like actual violence, you know, women being raped, families being forced out of their homes. If that were to happen here, as hard as that might be to imagine, and I ended up in another country at an airport or crossing a border, I would hope that the church should be there to welcome me. And I have that opportunity as refugees come to the United States, because if you look at the refugees resettled to the U.S., more are Christians than of any other faith background, even as we have this missional opportunity with those who may not yet be Christians.
Yeah. What does this do to a church that takes this on and says, you know, we're going to really be the hands and feet, we're going to be the Good Samaritan? What happens?
You know, it's amazing to get to witness this, and in my role at World Relief, I get to see this all over the world, and including all over this country, and it's just really powerful ways. It can be transformative for the life of that refugee family, but it also can be transformative for the life of the local church. I was one of the churches we kind of profiled in the book is Wheaton Bible Church outside of Chicago, where I live. And they probably 10 years ago, they had a new missions pastor, Chris, who basically came on and said, we're doing all this work internationally. We want to do that. We're not going to stop that. But we realized that there's actually people from all different nations coming into suburban Chicago. And Chris told me about the first refugee family he helped pick up at the airport with World Relief, a Burmese family. And just standing there on the third floor balcony of this lower income apartment complex with this, people with Burmese food that smelled of fish sauce running by. And down below, he saw a woman dressed in traditional African dress with her daughter and an Eastern European family across the way. And just thinking, wow, like what an opportunity right in front of us. And they've really seized on that with dozens of teams and individuals volunteering in the last decade, to the point where then they've had a number of Iraqi refugees who've actually come to the church every week. And they asked, especially around Christmas, they were asking, hey, can we come to your church? We want to understand who this Jesus is you're all about celebrating. And they've had some baptized and people from a Muslim background begin following Jesus. So it's really exciting just to see how that's impacted both those families, but also really the culture of the church to say, what an opportunity that we all have, not just the missionaries we support financially, as important as that is, but those of us who are, have professions and jobs here in suburban Chicago, but we could give an hour a week. We could be a part of a team to welcome this family. And we've seen that, I actually think for the church as a whole, and I think of Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus talks about being a shining city on a hill. Ronald Reagan used that imagery to talk about the U.S. welcoming refugees and immigrants. And that's, we have a noble legacy of that as a country. But that language of a shining city on the hill was not actually intended for the United States of America. It was Jesus' words to his disciples, to the church. And we have that opportunity. Right now, there are literally millions of people, refugees, and frankly, many others who are not refugees, who are just looking on, who are going to judge Jesus based on how his church, whether in Jordan or Germany or the U.S. or Canada or Kenya or wherever, responds to those who are in a place of vulnerability and need, whether that's a response of welcome and hospitality and advocacy and love or one of scapegoating and fear and apathy. People will make their determinations about Jesus based on how we as his people respond, which is a little bit scary. It's a lot of responsibility for us. But I think Jesus' command is to let your light shine before men, that they may see your good deeds and praise your Father in heaven. And I think that is happening. I think there's an opportunity for that to happen on a much larger scale, even than it currently is.
Yeah, are we at a turning point? Can we see some great progress take place if we, as God's people, sort of awaken to this opportunity?
I really believe there is. And I think we have precedents for that. I mean, last week there was at Wheaton College near where I live, there was a huge gathering of Hmong Alliance youth who were welcomed. Their families were welcomed a generation ago when the church, and that was one denomination, the Christian Missionary Alliance, who particularly was involved in welcoming those people. And a generation later, you see literally thousands of people from a country where most people are not Christians who are worshiping Jesus and reaching their own community and beyond. We have that history. I think we could see that again. It might be the Syrian youth or the Iraqi youth a generation from now. I was in Canada last week, and I think one person there told me, we really think this is God bringing revival to the church here, not only because we're able to see many people come to Christ, but also the rest of our society is looking and seeing the church stepping up. And I have to say, they just were confused by all the fear that we have in the U.S. In Canada, this seems obvious to most Christians that we should welcome refugees. They pointed out Jesus was a refugee. Of course we should welcome them. But as they've done so, the society around them sees them giving and caring sacrificially they've brought in more than 25,000 Syrian refugees into Canada. The government has, and the church has been a big part of welcoming them. The society around them is saying, wow, what is the church? I guess that's something we grew up with. It's always been here, but not that many Canadians are in church on any given Sunday. More and more people are being drawn to Jesus by the response of his people.
Matthew, people want more information, they go to World Relief.
WorldRelief.org. We've got info on the book, info on our U.S. offices. We're in about almost 30 locations around the U.S., and info also on what we're doing in the rest of the world. We have a program called Unlock Hope, where people can be a part of helping the church in the Middle East to respond to the refugee crisis.
WorldRelief.org. I recommend it, and look for the book as well, Seeking Refuge. Matthew Sorens, Field Director, or U.S. Director for Church Mobilization for World Relief. Blessings to you, friend. Good to have you here.
Thanks so much for the opportunity to be here.
We always like on Connecting Faith to take a look at our conversation, maybe from a different lens. And it was about a year ago, I had a chance to talk with Johnny Moore, who had just recently returned from Syria. We talked a lot about Syria today and about the work of ISIS in terms of attacking believers there and others as well. And he spells out what needs to be done, shares a story of a courageous believer still shining the light of Christ in these dark places. What are the maybe the frontline needs? What are other needs as well?
Well, I think the strategy to help is threefold. It's just three simple words. The first word is rescue. Second word is restore. And the third word is return. We're mainly in the rescue phase right now. We have to provide immediate humanitarian assistance to our brothers and sisters in Christ that have been displaced. And part of our rescuing isn't just humanitarian aid. It's also advocacy. It's educating ourselves and raising our voices and putting pressure on political leaders to make a difference. Because it takes government to solve the grand problem that are inflicting the Christians in the Middle East. Secondly, it's restoration. You know, I support organizations that not only are providing immediate assistance, but also have long-term plans to restore the societies that have been broken, to restore the thousands of lives of women and girls that have been put on slave markets and that have been sexually abused, to educate those whose education stopped when ISIS moved into their city or the wars in the region have destroyed them, to restore those societies and rebuild them. And we have a long-term vision that one day, if the region stabilizes, that we can return these people to their ancient communities and we can help rebuild their lives in the way that, you know, the Jewish community rebuilt their life around the world. And their struggle still remains, and we believe the struggle of Christians will remain for a long time, but we want to make sure that we have them back. And so I do that mainly through two organizations, but I would suggest, you know, give to any organization that you know and that you trust and that you're supporting that's on the front lines. But the two that I support the most and work with the most are the Cradle Fund, which I, you know, helped found, and then World Help, you know, worldhelp.net. Those two organizations are organizations that I work with every single day of my life.
What are some specific ways that we can pray? Not just, Lord, protect the brothers and sisters, but are there some maybe two or three specific things that we could just hold on to and bring before the Lord daily?
Sure. Paul wrote in 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 2, he says, pray that we might be delivered from wicked and from evil people. That's the prayer that we pray. So Hebrews 13, verse 3 says that we ought to empathize for those who are in prison as if we were there with them. So we ought to pray empathetically. We ought to put ourselves in the shoes and pray like it was our head or our child that has been trafficked or our city that had been destroyed. And there are three specific things you pray for every day. The first thing is provision, that their needs of our brothers and sisters in Christ would be provided. The second thing is protection, that they would be protected from harm's way. So provision, that their needs would be provided, protection, that they would be protected from wicked and evil people, and finally, and the most important one, perseverance, that they would have the ability to buckle up under this crisis and to endure what is a very real and very dangerous and quickly escalating threat against their communities.
There are great concerns around the globe, and certainly we think of those that are fleeing persecution, which is really the definition, refugee. And Johnny Moore just reminding us to pray, and had a great conversation just the past few minutes with Matthew Sorens from World Relief. Love to just hear his encouragement to us as God's family to really welcome the strangers.
It's really encouraging to hear. You know, sometimes you hear about the church in Europe, especially being kind of dead, but they're actually on the front lines of ministry. They're welcoming in the stranger and ministering to them. It's really encouraging.
Yeah, I don't know if we had, Carissa, any other feedback as you listen in today? So.
Yeah, when Matthew was just reminding us that, you know, what would we feel like if we were displaced, and that we can't really relate to it here living in America, but I know that it was just really convicting to hear that and just, you know, yeah, we do want to be welcomed and we want to be loved just as Christ loved us.
Amen. Good opportunity to share the love of Christ in this strategic way. Seeking Refuge, the book we referenced today from Matthew Sorens from World Relief. Check out worldrelief.org. And I hope that you'll check out the broadcast tomorrow. We're going to talk with Pastor Mike McKinley about some of the big challenges in our urban cores, what works for lasting change, and what all of us can learn from the poorest of the poor. We're going to talk about church in hard places, how the local church brings life to the poor and needy. A challenging conversation tomorrow.
Another opportunity for outreach. That'll be great.
Yeah. If you missed part of today's program or want to pass it on to a friend, you know, all our interviews are posted online, and they're all shareable, so you can just invite others to hear, and we welcome that. You can go to myfaithradio.com. That's our website, myfaithradio.com, and click on the Connecting Faith show page to find out more about today's conversation, and join us tomorrow for the next Connecting Faith.